Okay, we're beginning here with the Mishnah on the bottom of Ayin Tet Amud Bet. The Mishnah begins, Ein Megadlim Behema Daka Be'eretz Yisrael. One is not allowed to bring up the lighter domesticated animals within Eretz Yisrael, basically the grazing animals of the tzon that are mentioned in the Torah, which is Ksavim and Izim, goats and sheep. Avo Megadlim B'Surya U'Bimidbarot Shel Eretz Yisrael. But you are allowed to bring them up in Surya, which is outside of Eretz Yisrael, as Rashi notes over here. This is according to the Manda Amar that Surya, or the conquest of Surya, was not successful in being Mekadeshit like Eretz Yisrael. Even so, because of its proximity to Eretz Yisrael, the Chachamim in many instances were gozer, that whatever was true in Eretz Yisrael had some manifestation in Surya. Over here, they did not do that at all. And that means, obviously, Kal v'chomer l'chutz la'aretz, that there is no restriction against bringing up these types of animals. As far as the midbarot shel Eretz Yisrael, the word here, midbar, is probably not used to mean a desert, but rather midbarot mean uninhabited areas of Eretz Yisrael, where the eating of the animals won't destroy either people's fields or the ability to continue to live in those areas. Now, as far as the restriction, Rashi says that the restriction derived from two reasons, one of which is mishum yishuv Eretz Yisrael, for the purpose of maintaining the yishuv in Eretz Yisrael, and number two is because of the sadot in Eretz Yisrael were primarily owned by Jews, and so because of that, when the animals graze in other people's fields, they're generally being grazing in the fields of other Jews. So now, Rashi, in explaining the problem as being this dual issue, raises two major issues with regards to this type of grazing. It is well known that the animals, or these grazing animals, actually can destroy large areas of vegetation. The goats especially are known for their scorched earth type of eating, which is wherever they eat, they leave behind desolation. That caused problems in a number of times in Eretz Yisrael. One of those times seems to be around the Korban Beit HaMikdash, when a lot of the agrarian economy was destroyed, and that left large areas of land that were good for grazing, and then the people grazed those animals there, and that left a destruction behind because they ate everything that was green in sight. And not only does it make it almost impossible then to grow things in those areas, but it also causes a huge amount of soil erosion because there's no plantation there to hold the soil in place, and it gets washed down into the river and the riverbeds, and that clogs the riverbeds. In addition, it happened again probably after the close of the Gemara in the Muslim conquest of Israel. During that period of time, it was also used as an area for grazing. Usually, again, after a time of conquest or destruction where much of the agrarian economy is wiped out, then the areas are desolate because there's nobody inhabiting the areas, and therefore they bring in the grazing animals to graze in these areas, and they're destructive in that nature. So Chazal didn't want that to happen because of the destruction wrought by these animals. Now, that's one reason. The second reason being that these animals tend to graze in other people's fields, whether that's accidentally or whether that is intentionally by the people that own these animals, because it's destructive to those field owners and makes it hard for them then to make a living and grow things. But in addition, there's a problem of theft that is involved here, and likely why this is found in Masechet Baba Kama over here, because of the aspect of theft that is involved where your property is doing damage to someone else. Rashi says in Chutz La'aretz they were not mitakenis, because lo yichashinu liyishuv, we don't worry about yishuv. And number two is, im yafsidu sadot achirim, but the issue of damaging other people's fields still exists there, yishalmenu, you'll pay for it. Meaning, yes, there is damage that's done, but we can compensate for that damage that is done. And that'll be a way to deal with it. In Eretz Yisrael, because there's the other mitigating factor that not only do we have to restore the damage done to the owner, but it makes it hard to live there. And so therefore, we don't want that destruction to happen because we want to continue to have an ability for the agrarian economy to develop so that people can actually settle and be in Eretz Yisrael. If you parse apart the two reasons, it actually will turn out that there might be enough gemina, which is number one, in Eretz Yisrael, there might be a din of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael independent of ownership. That means whether it's owned by Jews or non-Jews, the ability to sustain an economy there would be important. And therefore, even if it was non-Jewish fields, you might still have this restriction. And the other nafkamina, you know, will be in Chutz La'aretz, when you're in areas that are largely Jewishly owned. Again, over there, there's no issue of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, but if part of the issue is the theft and the destruction of Jewish fields, then that does exist in areas that are largely populated by Jews in Chutz La'aretz. And we're going to see in the Gemara that there is this view that the dinim here apply in Bavel because of their large Jewish populations and density of settlement of the Jews in those areas. Now, as far as the restriction is concerned, the Balei HaTosafot bring over here that the restriction is wide-ranging, which is that we do not bring up these animals in Eretz Yisrael. That's irrespective of whether you're doing it yourself or whether you hand it over to a third party to do on your behalf. You hand it over to a shepherd to do on your behalf. The restriction is all-encompassing. And that's what Tosafot says, Afilu babayit kamar dirot, afilu behema gasa asur. He says, as far as keeping these behemot dakot in Eretz Yisrael, it's restricted to even keep them, to bring them up, even in your own house, meaning that there's a complete restriction blackout on bringing up these animals. With regards to larger animals, then there might be a restriction with them grazing, but you can bring them up in the house, and we'll see why in the Gemara as to why that is. There's a difference between those dakot and gasot. Now, the Rishonim, like the Rashba, that argue on the Balei HaTosafot, argue on him because of a Gemara that the Tosafot himself quotes, which is from Baba Metzia, which says that when people give over their animals to the Ro'eh, then we don't worry about the fact that he's going to have them graze in other people's fields because of a principle that Ein Adam Choteh Velo Lo. A person doesn't sin when it's not to his benefit, meaning that a person will sin when the benefit of that sin accrues to him, but he won't sin on behalf or to help out other parties. And so therefore, when it's handed over to the Ro'im, we don't worry about the fact that they're going to graze these animals in other people's fields. And Tosafot said that that din is only true in places where it's permitted to bring up behemot dakot. That is not a permission for places where the restriction exists. And therefore, Tosafot says this is a complete restriction and blackout against bringing up or even owning these behemot dakot in Eretz Yisrael. That heter of giving them over to a ro'eh is in areas where there was no such restriction. Then if you give it to the ro'eh, it protects you because we assume that the Ro'eh will not take them and graze them in other people's fields. The Rashba obviously views that Gemara in Baba Metzia as being normative, even in places that have a restriction against bringing up behemot dakot. And therefore, according to the Rashba, if you give it over to a third party in Eretz Yisrael, it would be mutar to have these animals, but you cannot bring them up yourself because of the problems of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, as well as theft. The Mishnah continues and says, "En megalim tarnagolim b'Yerushalayim mipnei hakodoshim." One may not bring up chickens inside of Yerushalayim because of the Kodoshim. The chickens which move around a lot, both from inside the houses as well as into the garbage dumps. And so the fear is that they're going to come into contact with things that are Tamei, Asheretz, and then move that, whatever that material is or that Tumah is, move it into the house, into areas where the Kodoshim are eaten. And since Yerushalayim, the majority of people eating there need to be Tahor because they're eating Kodoshim inside the walls of Yerushalayim, so for that reason, they restricted bringing up Tarnagolim. That could be a problem for maintaining the Tahara of Yerushalayim, so they restricted bringing them up in Yerushalayim. The same is true of Lo-Kohanim be'Eretz Yisrael mipnei Taharot. So the same thing is true for Kohanim in Eretz Yisrael who eat Truma and need to be Tahor on a regular basis. The same restriction applies to them bringing up Tarnagolim. For other people, it's fine because they don't have that necessity to be Tahor all the time, and they can even eat their food bitum'a. So it's only for the Kohanim, who need to be Tahor on a regular basis to eat the Truma, that they restricted such a thing. Ein megadlin chazirim b'chol makom. They're not allowed to bring up pigs in any place, so this restriction is not limited to Eretz Yisrael. This is a global limitation. The question as to why that is not clear here. The Rambam in the Perush of Mishnayot here writes that chazirim is not an exclusive din, but rather, he says, ma sh'amar lo yigadel chazirim hu adin l'shar dvarim shasurim b'achila. It's not a restriction against chazirim, it's just that that's an example of things that you may not eat. About diber b'chazirim, v'shiyadua sheheim efshar legadel mehem ka'bakar batzon. Since they are animals that are domesticated and that people actually bring them up commercially, that is why the Mishnah mentions chazirim. But there's nothing particular about the chazir that is unique, and therefore the restriction is anything that is asur to eat, you cannot bring up according to the Rambam. The Meiri claims that this Isur is really an extension of the Mishnah in Shvi'it that restricts people from trafficking in non-kosher items, that one can't make a business out of trafficking in non-kosher animals or non-kosher food, and this is just an extension of that din. The Balei HaTosafot on Pei Bet Amud Bet, when the Gemara comes back to this and discusses it, says then why is it that this restriction needs to be placed here? If there already is a restriction from the Mishnah that asur lasot schara b'chol dvarim tmeim, like the Mishnah in Shvi'it, so why do I need this additional restriction. Here the Rabbeinu Tam says, V'teretz Rabbeinu Tam dainu dafka b'davar omed la'achila. The restriction of doing trade in non-kosher items is only for things that are made to be eaten or are being sold to be eaten. But if they're brought up for other purposes besides eating, that is mutar. And therefore, anything like horses or donkeys that are brought up for the purpose of doing work, those, even though they are behemot tmeot, they do not have the restriction of trafficking in them. And therefore, it seems from the Rabbeinu Tam here that the restriction with chazirim is coming to limit it to animals that are brought up solely for the purpose of eating. And that is the chazir, which was brought up for food, not for work. And that's why that restriction in Shvi'it is being qualified here, that is manifest in animals that are eaten, but not in animals that are brought up for work. And the example brought here is a chazir, which is an animal that is brought up primarily for its food purposes, and that's why there is a restriction against bringing them up. Lo yigadel adam et hakelev, elim kenaya kashur bishol shelet. The person can't bring up a dog in his house unless it is tied with a chain. As Rashi says over here, mipnei shenosheich, because they bite, umenabeach, and they bark, umapelati shamiraton, they cause fear in women and cause them to miscarry, meaning that the animals are both dangerous and cause fear or engender fear in others, and for that reason, you can't bring them up unless they are contained properly, which means that they have to be chained up or on a leash. Ein porsim nishuvim liyonim, you can't put out traps for the doves, unless you're at least a minimum of 30 ris, which Rashi says is 4 mil, away from inhabited areas. The reason being that, in all likelihood, the yonim, the birds that are coming from those inhabited areas, belong to people who live there. And so therefore you're trapping birds that belong to people. Now, even though technically the birds don't belong to them, because the people set up their dovecotes in their houses, don't necessarily own the birds, because the birds fly out and come back and fly out and come back. Nevertheless, mipnei darchei shalom, chazal were oser you taking those birds, because even though there's no quote-unquote real ownership of the birds, it's clear that these birds belong to people because they come back to those dovecotes all the time. And therefore, people are trying to exert whatever ownership they can over them. And if you set up your traps within the area of the yeshuva, of the inhabited area, then all likelihood you're capturing birds that are going out from those houses and then eating and coming back home. You're capturing birds that are already belong to other people. So we want you to set up your traps or to set up your dovecotes further away as to not cause damage to other parties. Some suggest that it is the distance between the dovecotes or trappers that they have to set up, that if you don't set them up far enough apart, then you're going to be encroaching on each other's capture or the other person's territory of where they're capturing the birds. Okay, now, Tan Rabbanan, in megadlim be'imad daka be'eretz Yisrael, aval megadlim be'chorshin she'be'eretz Yisrael. So here is proof to what we had mentioned in the Mishnah, that when we're speaking about the Midbar, we're not speaking about places that are necessarily deserts, but rather areas that are uninhabited. Because here the Braita tells us you can't bring up the behemah daka, these lighter domesticated animals, in Eretz Yisrael. Avo megadlim bechoshin shbe'eretz Yisrael. You're allowed to bring them up in the forests in Eretz Yisrael. Bisuria, in Syria, afilu b'yishuv, you can bring them up even in the inhabited areas. Ve'en tzalech lomar b'chutz la'aretz, as we mentioned in the Mishnah, if already it's permitted in Syria, then certainly it's permitted in areas that have chutz la'aretz. Tanya idach, we have another Braita that says, ein megadlim behemah daka be'eretz Yisrael. That you're not allowed to bring up these animals in Eretz Yisrael, but you are allowed to bring them up in the Midbar Yehuda, which we know was an area of grazing for centuries and even thousands of years. David HaMelech himself grazed his tzon out in Midbar Yehuda, as well as the Midbar Shebisfar Akko. Akko, as we know from the Mishnah Gittin, was considered to be the boundary of Eretz Yisrael. And that boundary means, Shebesfar means on the boundary, on the border of Akko, there was a midbar there. Again, probably not speaking about a midbar in the sense of a desert, but an uninhabited area, or an area that isn't ripe or fertile for farming. Even though you're not allowed to bring up these lighter domesticated animals, you are allowed to bring up the heavier domesticated animals, the ones that are used for work. Because we do not impose on the people a gzerah or a takana that is impossible for them to keep. So in this instance, with regards to the behemah gasa, You have to look at that as the equivalent of cars or tractors. These are means of transportation, means of accomplishing the work on the farms. And so to restrict the bringing up of these animals would so severely handicap the economy that the Chachamim realized that if they put a takana like this in place, it won't hold. Even though there might be reason to exclude these behemoth gasot, like the behemoth takot, but not be as an extreme a form of the grazing that is done by the behemoth takot, but nevertheless, there would be reason to restrict them because of the same reasons as behemoth takot, but Chazal opted not to do that because they realized that it would be so prohibitive on the people that they would not be able to do it, and therefore they let the behemoth gasot come. Behemoth daka, efshar lavi michutz laaretz. The difference being that for a behemoth daka, those lighter animals, you can import them from outside of Eretz Yisrael. Behemoth gasa, efshar lavi michutz laaretz. On the other hand, the larger animals are impossible to import from chutz laaretz. That probably is both because of the weight and size of the animals made it difficult to import these animals, as well as the fact that you need them daily, as opposed to the lighter animals, which are using them for food and can be imported at times that you need them for the food. The behemoth gasot are needed for their work capabilities every day. So to import them every day and to let them go at night, that doesn't make so much sense. And so from a practical standpoint, it makes sense that you could restrict the behemoth dakot without interfering with the economy versus the behemoth gasot, which would be so restrictive that it would impair the economy. And even though we said you're not allowed to bring up these animals, so at times of the year where there's a necessity or need for large numbers of these animals, the behemoth dakot, either for korbanot or for eating, they allowed it for, first of all, the importing of those animals, but also for the maintaining of the animals in those areas. But they gave a window of time, which is mishehehu kodem regel shloshim yom. You're allowed to bring it in for the 30 days leading up to the regel. Bekodem mishtebeno lamajom. And then before the feast for his son, usually references to the wedding of his son, 30 days beforehand. Uvash loishet achona shloshim yom. As long as he doesn't leave the last one 30 days, the way that the Rishonim explain it is that you have a maximum window beforehand to purchase the animals of 30 days leading into the event, which is whether that's the regel or the mishteh. But even if you buy animals after or inside of that 30-day window, you only get the earlier of 30 days or the regel or the earlier of 30 days and the wedding, which in all essence makes it that the wedding or the regel is the cutoff because you can't bring them or import them more than 30 days beforehand or you can't keep them in your house. So therefore, even if you bought animals on the 25th day or 20 days, we don't give you the 30-day window. We only give you until the regel or until the wedding. The sakadat chamina, dinafik le regel, because if we thought maybe that even though the regel passed, mechizavna ad hashta kati lo malu le klatin yomim, but still he only bought it 20 days before the regel. So he has that 30-day window. So maybe he should be able to utilize those extra 10 days after the regel. Lo neima, we're not going to say tlate mishra shari le lishuye, that you automatically get a 30-day window to hold the animal. Okay, but enough of the regel, lo mi bai le lishuye. Once the event has passed, you no longer have permission to keep them around. And therefore, you only have the right to bring them in during that 30-day window beforehand. But the cutoff is as soon as the event happens, you need to have to be done with them. That means that you have to have utilized all of them or sold them off, and you cannot maintain them after the regel or after the wedding, even if they're kept within inside of your house. And this is where Tosafot brings his proof to the fact that the restriction was a complete restriction, because over here you see you're not allowed even to keep them within your house, not only have them out grazing in the fields. Vadabach, a butcher who here, it's not just a butcher, but a person who deals with these animals or deals within meat, Lokeach v'shochet. He can purchase them and then shech them in order to sell them off. Or he can purchase them and then keep them around. As long as he doesn't leave the last of them around for 30 days. Now Rashi interprets the Gemara here to be very similar to the Gemara beforehand, which is there is an event, and that's called Yom HaShuk. That is the marketplace day. Whether that happened every week or whether it happened monthly, the butcher is allowed to bring together animals within 30 days of that event in order to get his merchandise ready, but then he has to sell them all off on the Yom HaShuk. And again, Rashi says that the aguna, the latest of the ones that he bought, he can't leave for the 30 days, meaning that once the Yom HaShuk comes, he's cut off and you can't keep them beyond that point in time. Tosafot does not like Rashi's explanation for two reasons. First of all, the Gemara here never mentions the word shuk, and Rashi's already superimposing that on the situation in order to explain it. Number two is, why did the Gemara before call them the achrona, when you had those that were purchased within the 30 days of the event, and here it calls it an aguna. And therefore, Tosafot claims that the explanation of this part of the Gemara is that a person who deals in meat, or the butcher here, used to buy animals in a large number, meaning that he buys commercial quantities and then sells them off at a retail level. And so therefore, the explanation of the Gemara is that even though he bought them together, and that means that maybe he should have to sell them off together, we allow him to sell them off one by one. And the aguna means one who's left alone. The final one, which is not part of the grouping anymore because it's left alone, that one cannot be kept around more than 30 days. So he has a 30-day window in which to dispense of the animals that he purchases, and the last of the animals, meaning that the residual of the animals that he buys can't go beyond that 30-day window. The difficulty in Tosafot's pshat, as he notes himself, is that the Gemara here never says Yoter Mishloshim Yom, which would indicate the way that he wants to explain it. But that's the explanation of Rashi and Tosafot of this section of the Gemara. Now, Shalu Tamid David Rabbi Gamliel. So the Tamidim answer Rabbi Gamliel, Maulu Gadel. What is the din about bringing up animals? Amalem Mutar. It's totally fine. That's none. What about our Mishnah in Megadlin? That you're not allowed to bring them up? El Helchika Baumine. This is what they asked of him. Maul Shahot. Can you keep these animals in Eretz Yisrael? Amalem Mutar. Bavad Shlot Tetsevi Terebe Eder. As long as they don't go out and graze in flocks. El Koshra Bikare Amita. He has to tie them up to the bedpost. So Rashi reads the Gemara at face value and says that Rabbi Gamliel is arguing on the Chachamim. And that he says that even though the Chachamim had these restrictions or these 30-day restrictions and windows in which allowed to keep the animals in your house, but Gamliel didn't see that restriction at all. He agreed you're not allowed to have these behemoth dakot graze in Eretz Yisrael, but as long as you kept them in the house, tied up to the bedpost, that would be fine. The requirement to tie them up to the bedpost is questionable. Some suggest that the reason being that Tosafot notes over here, that was the normal way that they did it. That was their normal practice. So he's not telling them that you have to do it that way. But that was their practice. As Tosafot brings a proof from the Gemara in Chulin that speaks about a pasuk that says that this was the behavior of the individuals, and actually the rope that is tied to the bed, the measurement of the length of that rope was determined by tying the animals to their beds, and is reminiscent of in Eretz Mitzrayim when they took the behemoth for the korbanot, that they would tie them to the bed first. And that's a similar idea over here. Nevertheless, Tosafot disagrees with Rashi about the fact that the Rabbi Gamliel over here is arguing on the Chachamim. But rather, Rabbi Gamliel is just qualifying what the Chachamim said. That we permission to keep animals, behemoth dakot, in your house for 30 days prior to the regel, the Tosafot thinks that that's only bebeito. You're only allowed to keep them within your house. In addition, Tosafot notes that maybe the reason that it says here you have to tie them to the bed is to indicate that even if you are bringing them up or raising them in Eretz Yisrael, that tying them to the bed won't solve that problem. You only have to keep them here, not when you're raising them, simply if you're utilizing them. And so therefore the tying to the bed is even coming to restrict more heavily the gadel. Even if you're bringing them up, if you keep them in your house or you tie them to the bed, like Tosafot said before, that's still under the restriction of bringing up a behemoth dakah in Eretz Yisrael. Tanur Banan, Maser b'chassid echad, she'agoneach milibo. There was this individual who was a chassid, a pious individual, who, Rashi says over here, had pain in his heart, so he was groaning or moaning from the pain in his heart. Others suggest that it was pain in his chest or in his lungs. V'sha'alu the Rofim, and they asked the Rofim, the doctors, what they should do for him. V'amru, ein lo takana ad she'anik chalav roteach mishacharit l'shacharit. The only way for him to do this is to simply nurse goat's milk from morning to morning, v'evilois, and that's what they did. They brought him a goat, v'kasharo lo b'karei amita, and they tied it to his bedposts. And he was drinking from it from morning to morning. After a while, his friends came to visit him to pay a visit. When they saw this goat that was tied to his bedpost, they were shocked. They were surprised. They're armed robbers inside of his house. Now again, the idea of the goat being an armed robber is not literally, but in the figurative sense that the goats go out and eat in other people's fields, graze in other people's fields, take their property, as well as destroy that everything that's out there. And so you see their natural disposition towards goats had the takanat chachamim in the back of their heads. ואנו נכנסים אצלו, and we're going to go and visit him. ישבו ובדקו, ולא מצאו בו אל אותו אבון, של אותה עז. They checked him out, they investigated his individual, and they saw that he had no other sin besides this sin of keeping a behemoth daka in Eretz Israel, keeping around this goat. ואף הוא בשעת מיטתו, and he too at the time of his death, אמר, יודעני, שאין בי אבון אל אבון אותו עז, שעברתי על דברי חברי. I know that I have no other sins, I have a clean slate, with the exception of this issue, where I kept around this goat, even though it was restricted by my friends, meaning there was a takanat chachamim, that I shouldn't keep around the goat. The Marsha over here explains that the admission over here was Efshar de Vidui Shekodem Mitato. The Derech Kol Haaretz, he was doing a Vidui before his death, and this is the Avon that he was being Mitvadeh Alav. The only problem is, why is it that it was restricted to him? If he was ill, if he was sick, why was it that he couldn't do it? So the Marsha suggests over here, Efshar Shea Chulesh Ein Bo Sakana. It's a case where he wasn't deathly ill, it wasn't a Sakana, and therefore he should not have violated the restrictions of the Chachamim over here for the discomfort, and therefore that's why he was held accountable or saw himself as violating that sin. The Meiri, on the other hand, over here suggests that the Chachamim were very makbid on issues that affect Ben Adam Lechaveiro, and therefore you can't do something that will impact on your friends in order to benefit yourself. And over here, bringing the Behemoth Daka in to service him was not enough of a reason to allow it because of the impact it would have had on his friends, meaning that the damage that it causes for the neighbors as well. And that's why he was held accountable for this avon. But from here you see how seriously they took this restriction of the Chachamim, and how their perspective on these goats was very negative because of the damage that they did cause. Amar Rabbi Shmuel, and some say it's Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Chizuri, mi balei batim shebegalil elyon, from those that lived in the Upper Galilee, Ayu Beit Abba, that was where my family was from, Bnei Ma Charvu, but is the reason that it was destroyed, Shayu Merim Bechoshim, because they used to graze their animals in the forest, which seemingly has no problem, because we saw before the Braito that allow it. Bidanim Dine Memonot Biyachid, and they also are adjudicating monetary cases alone, which again is permitted for a Talmud Chacham Mufak. A Talmud Chacham Muflag is allowed to be done Dinei Mamonot B'Yachid. So again, it seems to be that there shouldn't be any problem with these issues. Nevertheless, he says that this was the source for the destruction of those communities in those areas. So now the Gemara discusses, Afal Pi Shulem Choshim Samuch LeBatehem, even though the forests or the grazing areas that seemingly were permitted were near their houses, Sadek Tana Haita, there was a small field between their houses or where they lived and the forests. Marin derechalea, and they used to have their animals cross that field in order to get out to the grazing areas. And since they did not consider that individual small field or the loss of his property or the damage done from them traversing it in order to get to the Choshim, therefore they were punished for not considering other people's properties. Now with regards to Danin Dinei Mamot Yachid, you see from this Gemara that despite the fact that it is permitted, we follow the advice of the Mishnah Avot, the Enu Endad Yachid Ela HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that there's only one person who judges alone, and that's HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So even though there is permission to do such, nevertheless it's frowned upon, and therefore they were penalized for acting in this manner. Tarabanan, Ro'esh Asat Tshuva, Ein Mechayvin Oto D'Mekor Miyad. A shepherd that wants to do tshuva, we do not compel him immediately to sell all of his flock or all of his merchandise. Ela mocher al-yad al-yad. He sells it off slowly. So here, this seems to be the equivalent of the takanat ha-shavim, part of those takanot that Chazal did in order to facilitate people doing tshuva. If you tell someone who is grazing these animals or these flocks in Eretz Yisrael that they have to sell it off immediately, they're going to take huge losses on those animals. So here, if a person wants to do tshuva, we help facilitate that by saying to them that they could sell it off slowly until they are able to recoup the investment that they had, and then not continue afterwards. But then Chazal permitted such a methodology. So in order to facilitate these people's willingness, as well as ability to do tshuva, Chazal understood the mentality and the psychology of these individuals. And if he made the turtle too high for them to do tshuva, they would never do it. So in allowing them to sell it off in a slow manner, provided for them the opportunity to do tshuva where it wasn't too onerous or unwieldy. And also a convert who is inheriting these animals from his non-Jewish relatives. So if he inherits these dogs and these pigs, we don't again force him to liquidate everything right away. Again, he's allowed to sell them off slowly until he recoups or gains the fair market price for these items. Again, the reason being that we won't want the ger to feel like he needs to go back to being a non-Jew because he's losing money because of his conversion. So we allow him to sell it off in a manner that is economically feasible, but yet we encourage him to do so in order to comply with the takanat chachamim. Someone who takes a neder that he wants to purchase a home and marry a woman in Eretz Yisrael, we don't compel him to do it immediately, to fulfill the neder immediately, until he finds an appropriate woman to marry. We don't compel him to fulfill the neder, and we understand almost that embedded in his neder is not that he's going to marry the first woman he sees, but rather that he's going to marry a woman that is appropriate, and he's going to try to do this. So the neder doesn't compel him to get married. The neder compels him to try to find a woman that he can marry in Eretz Yisrael. And so therefore, we're not going to compel him to complete the neder immediately, but we will encourage him to act towards fulfillment of that neder. There was this woman whose son was giving her a very difficult time. Sounds like she might have been a widow or a divorcee, and she lived with her son, and her son was giving her such a hard time. She jumped and took a shvu'ah. She says, the next guy to propose to me, I'm going to accept their proposition. So, living with her son was the way that she was being supported. She was so upset with her son that she basically opened up the opportunity for someone else to support her. So now, she says, anybody who comes and offers me their hand in marriage, then I will accept it. And inappropriate people, people who are not either worthy of this woman, not of her stature, whatever the reason was, they were not appropriate shiduchim for her, and they came and proposed to her. When this case came before the chachamim, amru lo nitkavna zo elo haguna. Obviously embedded in her neder wasn't just to marry the first person she sees, but to marry the first person appropriate for her that proposes to her. And therefore she does not have to accept these propositions. She can accept a proposition which is proper for her. Now, kashem shamru ein megadin beima daka, kach amru ein megadin chaya daka. So here the Gemara now extends what the Mishnah says about behemot dakot, with these grazing animals, these domesticated animals, and says the same applies to a chaya daka. And Rashi over here gives two examples, tzvi'im v'shualim, meaning both kosher chayot, which is the tzvi, or shualim, the foxes, which are the non-kosher chayot, similarly for the same reason, which is these are animals that graze and eat so heavily that they are destructive either to other people's property or to Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, and maybe even more so because these animals are less domesticated and less controlled by their owners. Rabbi Shmuel Omer, Megadlin Kalavim Kofrin, Vechatulim, Vekofin, Vechuldat Snaim, Vibnesha Asuim Lenakerat Abayit. You can bring up these types of animals. The reason being, we'll start with that, which is Rashi says over here, because they clean up the house. Rashi says over here that they chase away the achbarim. They chase away the mice in the house, so they keep the little rodents out of the house. So they're helpful from that perspective. So here, the first one is kalavim kofrim, which Rashi says are these small dogs. They're the village dogs, and they're small. Rashi brings a lishna achrina, which is kalavim gdolim. They are large dogs, shel tzayadim, of the hunters, vein mazikim. But they don't damage people because they are trained to, whether it's to smell or to help find animals, but they do not injure human beings. So a dog that is, quote-unquote, domesticated and is not injurious to the neighbors, then that might not be a problem according to that second interpretation. The first interpretation of Rashi is simply that these are small dogs, so they're not dangerous. Vechatulim are cats. Again, that makes sense in the context of them chasing away the mice. That's why they were also brought to Israel. Originally, the cats were brought there to chase away the mice and the rats, and then they continued to multiply until they themselves became the problem. The kofin and a monkey or an ape, v'chudot snaim, which the Gemara will deal with in a second. Chuda is usually associated with the weasel, and snaim in the modern day Hebrew is a squirrel. So there might be some connection between the two, but we'll see in a second. My chudat snaim, what exactly is this chudat snaim? I'm Rabbi Yehuda, shratzo chartzo. It is a sheretz, which means like a crawling, creepy crawly thing that's close to the ground. Chartzo that digs or excavates. So you can understand here this squirrel reference of digging into the ground, as well as the weasel reference, which is something that is close to the ground. V'kadamrei, Charzak diktine shake. The way Rashi explains it over here is that it is a species that has very narrow or thin legs. Viraya bene vardine. And it lives or pastures amongst the, Rashi says that vardine are snare, which are thorn bushes. But veret is from a rose bush, so the two might be connected, a rose bush that has thorns in it. Umai shratza. So then what is the shratza part of it? You've explained the charza or the charza part of it. What's the shratza part? Dimitatai shakye. Rashi says that its legs are very short. So that's why it's a sheretz, because it's close to, again, and very short. People associated with the genet, which is found in northern Africa, which has a very narrow face, is spotted, has some feline-like qualities to it, but also has these shorter legs and very long tail. Tosfot over here actually says that it's not just a question of semantics, but there is a halachic nafkamin over here, which is that one of the shratzim in the Torah is a chuldah. And therefore, the din of a chuldah is different than that of a chaya, which is that the tum'ah of a sheretz has very particular laws, especially about the size. It has a smaller size that makes things tamei, as well as what parts of it make things that are tamei, versus a chaya or a nevelah, which is an animal that if it dies, it becomes a nevelah, its tum'ah is the size of a kezayit. So Tosfot says over here that this animal was actually a safek chuldah, and that's why it had this name of the chuldat tznaim, which it has features that seem to be like the biblical chuldah, which is the sheretz, versus other features which differentiated from the chuldah. And therefore, they had a safek about this animal as to whether it was considered to be a chuldah or not, whether it's a sheretz or a chaya. So Amar Yehuda Amar Rav. So now we have a statement from Rav, and it's important that Rav is making the statement, which is, Asinu atzmenu b'Bavel ke'eretz Yisrael de behema daka. In Bavel, we make ourselves like Eretz Yisrael with regards to these flock and grazing animals, these lighter domesticated animals, meaning that you're not allowed to bring them up in Bavel. The reason for which we're going to see in a little bit, So Rav Adar Bar Ava asks Rav Huna, who's also a Talmud of Rav, says to him, how come you have these animals and you're bringing them up in your house? Mine are being taken care of by Chova. Chova was the wife of Rav Huna, and she is taking care of them. So Amarlei, Rav Adar Bar Ava says back to him, Chova tikberinu libna. Chova should bury her children. That's if it's a statement. There's a possibility of reading it as a rhetorical question. Chova tikberinu libna. That the Balei Tosafot suggests, we'll come back and explain it in a minute. All the years that Rav Adar Bar Ava was alive, Rav Huna never had children from Chova because of this curse that he had said. So Rashi over here explains that the statement of Rav Adar Bar Ava was a klala, that he had cursed him because he thought that his behavior was inappropriate or unacceptable given the fact that Rav had made this statement or this takana, we'll see in a second, that Bavel had the same din as Eretz Yisrael. On the other hand, the Balei Tosafot toy with the idea that that would not be the case. For Chas v'Shalom, he would have cursed him. So rather, he brings from the Rabbeinu Chananel that Bitmia, it was a rhetorical question, which is V'chid Darka L'Kbor Baneha. So the first way he explains it is what? She has time to graze and shepherd these flocks. Isn't she bringing up her children? How does she have this time on her hands? Is she bearing her children? That she has all this time to do this grazing. Tosafot likes that explanation, but then has a problem because this similar story comes up in another situation with regards to Hakafat Arosh, cutting off the peyot, which again, Rav Huna says his wife Chova did, and the same statement is made over there, and there clearly the question is not about does she have time to do it, but rather it was clearly a curse over there. So therefore Tosafot offers another alternative, which is, Inami Yishtamar, En Yirah Shetan Eshbi Purat Banah. Isn't she afraid of violating the takana, which might lead to the death of her children? And again, it would be more of a rhetorical question than a curse, because Tosafot's uncomfortable having it be Rav Adar Bar Ava was cursing Rav Huna, but rather he sees it as a manifestation of Shkigaga Ayotzei Lifnei Shalit, where somebody says something, and because they say it, it comes true, so Al Tiftach Pe LeSatan type of idea, but rather than he was intentionally trying to curse Rav Huna. Ikadar Amre, some say Rav Huna Marav, Asinu Atzmein Bavel Ke Eretz Yisrael Lebehema Daka, Chiyat Rav LeBavel, so therefore, Rav Huna says that that's the din that happened once Rav came to Bavel. The memra is not brought from Rav Yehuda, but rather from Rav Huna, and you can see here in the Bach that he eliminates Rav from it, but rather Rav Huna himself said the statement that Asinu Atzmein Bavel Ke Eretz Yisrael Lebehema Daka,
So
that's why the Bach takes out the Girsa Amar Rav Huna Amar Rav, because he's saying it Michiat Rav the Bavel. It's obvious that that's what changed the dynamic. He's not saying it in the name of Rav, he's explaining what it was. In that case, he was saying that I gave the animals over to my wife Chova. There it might be that the solution to the problem is that if you're not the one that is grazing the animals, that it might be okay. That's something that Tosafot rejected before, but the Rashba possibly accepted. If that's the case, then she won't sin for my benefit. And so therefore we take away the problem of allowing the animals to graze in others' fields. And that's why Rav Huna says, I'm not doing it, but rather my wife Chova is doing it. Now the Gemara says, Michiata Rav the Bavel. When Rav came to Bavel, Rashi over explains, Rabbu mitjashvim sham lifnei bnei yeshivato. Once Rav had left Eretz Yisrael because of the bnei Rabbi Chia, and he moves to Bavel and he establishes the yeshiva in Bavel, Bavel becomes a central place for the yeshiva and for people to come to learn. Lishna achrina hu ba, lamdoli zayar bekach. He came and explained or helped us to understand this din. Tosafot favors that second explanation of Rashi. But what the question is this establishment that Bavel has a din like Eretz Yisrael, when did it start? So Rashi in the first interpretation says that when Rav came to Bavel, he changed the demographics of Bavel because then more and more Jews came to Bavel to learn by Rav. And therefore the Jewish settlement increased to the point where Bavel looked like Eretz Yisrael. The other explanation which Tosafot favors, because the Mishnah says a similar thing with regards to Gittin, that Bavel has the same din of Eretz Yisrael, and over there it also uses the Lashon Mechiat Rav. And that doesn't make so much sense, because the Mishnah already regards Bavel ke'Eretz Yisrael, and the Mishnah was recorded or said before Rav ever came to Bavel. And so that's why he favors Rashi's second interpretation, that's what the Rabbeinu Tam says, which means that Rav came to Bavel and explained that from a long time ago, the time of Galut Yechoniah, from the first Galut to Bavel, since the large number of Talmidei Chachamim and Nevi'im moved to Bavel, that means that the center of Torah learning had moved to Bavel at that point in time, and therefore Bavel took over as having that shame Eretz Yisrael for Lishma by Gittin, as well as the density of the demographics of Jews that are found in that location. And there, that's what Rashi says, the reason that Bavel has the same din as Eretz Yisrael, it's obviously not because of Yishuv Bavel, but rather because the Jewish population that's concentrated there. So therefore Rashi says that causes problems, that if you graze your animals, in all likelihood you're going to be grazing them in your neighbor's fields, or you're going to be grazing them in Jewish farmers' fields, and that's a problem of theft. And we don't allow here just to repay them for the damage that's done because of the destruction to the ability to sustain the community. And so therefore we say you can't graze in those areas because of the density of the Jewish population and the fields that belong to the Jews. So now, Rav Ushmuel Rav Asi Iklu the Bei Shavua Ben, Barmila the Bei Yeshua Ben. So now, Rav and Shmuel, who we know are leading Amoraim in Bavel, Rav is older than Shmuel, and Shmuel looks up to him. He's obviously older and treats him like a Rav. Rav Asi, who is a Talmid of Rav, but Rav Asi was greater than Shmuel. So you have an issue here in terms of the three of them, which the Gemara is going to present in 1 second, as to who should go first or who should be honored in these cases. They went to Bei Shavua HaBen. One possibility, Rashi says over here, that Shavua HaBen is the Brit Milah. Hashem Shavua Lav Shivat Yamim. Shavua means 7 days. So Shavua HaBen means the Brit Milah, the Brit Milah of the child. Barmila the Bei Yeshua HaBen. Rashi over here explains that Bei Yeshua HaBen is Mishtesh Osim the Pidyon HaBen. It's a feast that they do for the Pidyon HaBen HaBechor. And it's called Yeshua, from the word Yeshua being translated as Parek. Purkan means to release or to free, meaning that you redeem them. The Bali Tosafot bring from the Oruch that explains the same way Rashi does, but they don't like that explanation, and the Rabbeinu Tam says, Perish Nolad Sham Ben, that the Yeshua is the separation of the child from the mother, and the successful birth that happened. And that's what's called Yeshua HaBen. Yeshua HaBen is that it's now released or been birthed from the mother, and that's the word Yeshua. And it was a celebration for the birth of the child. Now, that might be actually a precursor to the idea of a Shalom Zohar, which was this idea that they had a celebration or a Suda upon the birth of a child. The Marashah here is Midayek in Lashon of Rashi, that when it comes to the Brit Milah, he just mentions Brit Milah. When he talks about the Pidyon HaBen, he mentions Mishteh Shosim, the Pidyon Ben HaBechor. And based on that, he says that from here it would be evidence of the fact that there is a mitzvah to have a su'udah by a Pidyon HaBen. But by the Brit Milah, The Etzem Brit Milah is the mitzvah that we're speaking about, and it wasn't speaking matter. There's no evidence from here that you have to have a Suda with regards to the Brit Milah. So now, when they came there, they all had to enter, and they wanted to know who they should give honor to. Rav lo ayo kamei de Shmuel. Rav refused to go before Shmuel. Shmuel lo ayo kamei de Ravasi. Shmuel refused to go before Ravasi. Ravasi lo ayo kamei de Rav. And Ravasi would not go before Rav. So now, amai manir trach. Who should we bother? Meaning that who should we delay to come in? So nitrach Shmuel v'neite Rav v'Ravasi. We're going to bother or delay Shmuel in order that Rav and Ravasi should enter. The challenge over here is what I mentioned before, which is Rav is the greatest of them all, and therefore he should go first. Ravasi is the Talmud of Rav, so he can't go before his Rebbe Rav. On the other hand, he's greater than Shmuel, so he should go before Shmuel. Shmuel should have gone behind them, but Rav hadn't particularly gave kavod to Shmuel, which we're going to see a second in the Gemara, because Rav, when he came to visit Bavel, the Gemara in Shabbat, and Daf Kufchet tells Shmuel, as a doctor, gave him some medicinal cure for a stomach ailment that he had, and it left him writhing in pain that night, and Rav cursed whoever gave him this and forced him to go through this. It turned out it was to his benefit. It was a medicinal cure, but he didn't realize at the time the person who had given it to him was Shmuel, and therefore Shmuel, from that curse, did not have children, and Rav felt terrible about that curse, and therefore he always gave honor to Shmuel to go first. So that's the challenge over here. Rav wants Shmuel to go before him. Shmuel can't go before Rav Asi because Rav Asi is greater. But Rav Asi can't go before Rav because Rav Asi is a Talmud of Rav. So you have this circular problem going on about who should go in first. So the Gemara says what we should have is two of them enter first and then one of them should delay afterwards. The Gemara says, okay, Rav and Rav Asi, Rav and his Talmud should go in first. Rav will go first and Rav Asi will follow him. And then Shmuel will come at a slightly later time. So now the Gemara asks, why are you doing that? Benitach Rav or Ravasi. Why don't you delay Rav or Ravasi and allow Shmuel to go first? The Gemara says, Rav milta ba'amahu da'avid le'ed Shmuel. Rav was only giving this kavod to Shmuel, mishum ha'u ma'isid alatya, because of that case where he cursed him. And so because of that curse, adabri rabale, Rav had allowed Shmuel to take a prominent position or always go before him and give him kavod. But not because he really should have given it or that he deserved it. And so therefore, when it came to this hierarchy over here, Rav definitely deserved to go first, and when you have three of them and they can't all enter at once, we have to do something to separate between them so that nobody is slighted. So what they ended up doing is having Rav come first and Ravasi's Talmud come right behind him, and then they delayed for some time, and then Shmuel, that's what Rashi says, Yitacher, that he would delay, and Shmuel came at a little later time, so it didn't look like there was any slight to Shmuel because he showed up later, and he didn't have to go after Ravasi or before Rav, which would have caused this problem in terms of the kavod. While they were waiting for them to come, Ata Shunra, a cat came along and Kate the other the Yanoka, came and bit off an arm of a child, a young child. Nofak Rav Dorash, Rav went out and was Doresh, Chatul Mutar Lahor Go. A cat can be killed. Basur the Kaimo, and you may not raise them. Vein Bijil Bishum Gezel, and there's no problem of theft. Vein Bo Mishum Ashava Abeila de Balim, and there's no obligation to return them to the owners. The Gemara will dissect exactly what Rav is saying over here. Tosafot goes out of his way to point out that was not at that moment that Rav was mitake in this takana. Elo that he's saying that there was a takana already in place that Rav is now reiterating now, and this is the reason that the takana is in place, because these cats are dangerous. Tosafot proves it from the fact that the Gemara asks from a brayta on Rav, and therefore it has to be that Rav's talking about an earlier takana, otherwise why are you asking from a brayta that is not correlated with the new takana that Rav's putting in place? Rav's putting in a takana that's after the brayta. The Rashba, on the other hand, says, no, it's possible that the takana was a new takana, but they were asking, if the cats are beneficial and they were seen as being domesticated from the brayta, why is Rav considering them to be so dangerous or difficult? So now, if you already said that you're allowed to kill it, then why do you need any other restrictions to say you're not allowed to bring it up? You would think it's mutar to kill it in order to prevent it from damaging or injuring people. But isur aleka, but there is no isur to keeping it around. Kamash malan, that not only is it mutar to kill it, it's also asur to bring it up, and you may not keep this as a pet. Now, Tosafot over here is surprised by Rav's statement that you can kill the cat, because the Gemara in Sanhedrin, in discussing wild animals that you're not allowed to keep around, and it says that people, kodokodem, anybody who goes first to kill them is welcome, and we give them credit for killing these animals because they're dangerous. And over there is a list of dangerous animals. So why is the cat any different than those animals? And over there, the Gemara in Sanhedrin requires at least that they have done some damage. They've killed someone or they've been problematic, and then you can kill them. So why over here is the cat where you're allowed to kill the cat even though it's caused no danger? The Tosafot gives two reasons for that. One reason being that the animals there in the Gemara in Sanhedrin are tied up. And so there, if they cause damage while they're tied up, then you can kill them. But at least they're tied up. The cat wanders around freely, and therefore that's why it's more dangerous, because it's not tied up, it's not on a leash. That's number one. Number two is the possibility that those other animals are dangerous. Therefore, people will keep their distance from those animals. On the other hand, the cat looks innocuous, and therefore people will not keep their distance from the cat. They won't know that this is a dangerous cat, and then they'll end up getting injured by it. So therefore, we give you more rights in terms of killing the cat. So then the Gemara continues and says, Amrei, b'kevin d'amart ein bo mishum gezel. You tell me there's no problem of theft over here. My niu too, ein bo mishum hashava ve'dal le'be'alim. Then, of course, well, you don't have to return it to the owners. If there's no problem of theft, why would you have to return it to the owners? Amravina le'oro, for its skins, meaning that if the animal is killed, then you don't have any obligation to return the skin of this animal to its original owner. Meitave, is that really true? Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar omer, megadlin klavim kofrim v'chatulim v'kofim v'chudot tznayim mipnei she'asu min hakeret habayit. We just brought the bright on the previous amud that said, Rabbi Shimon Elazar says you're allowed to bring up these animals in your house because they are beneficial to the owners in keeping the house clean and free of rodents. And one of those animals was the chatul. And it says, Halo kasha b'uchma ha-bechivara. It depends if it's black or white. So in a case where it is black, then that is a domesticated cat and it's fine. Rashi says if it's a white cat, then it's mu'ada zikadam. Those are dangerous types of cats. Gemara says, wait a minute, v'ha masid rav uchma hava. In the case of Rav, the cat there was a black cat, so it should have been fine. Haltam uchma bar chivara hava. It was a black cat, but was born from a white parent. Vami boy boyele Ravina, the boy Ravina. Didn't Ravina question this? The boy Ravina uchma bar chivara mahu. If a black cat that is the child of a white cat, what's the din? Kimi boyele Ravina ba uchma bar chivara bar uchma. Ravina's question was a black cat that was the child of a white cat that was a child of a black cat. So the white cat was an oddity in this lineage. Maisa dera ba uchma bar chivara bar chivara hava. Rav's case is where it was a black cat that was the child of a white cat that was the child of a white cat. I mean, this was a lineage of white cats, and the black cat is the oddity over here, because it really is a lineage of white cats, rather than the white cat being the oddity. So Ravina's question is a case where the white cat was the oddity, versus here, where the case was that it was a lineage of white cats, and the black cat was the oddity. So Amar Rav Acha bar Papa, Mishum Rabbi Abba bar Papa, Mishum Rav Adar bar Papa, Ramila Rabbi Abba bar Papa, Mishum Rabbi Chia bar Papa, Mishum Rav Acha bar Papa, Ramila, Amar Rav Abba bar Papa, Mishum Rabbi Acha bar Papa, Mishum Rav Chanina bar Papa. Again, many of the children of Rav Papa that we mention in the Siyum, whenever you ever see a Masechta, Matri'in ala Chichuch b'Shabbat. One is allowed to be Matri'a. Usually the word Tru'a is associated with the blowing of the shofar, and that's the way Rashi explains it over here. You're allowed to blow the shofarot on Shabbat for the calling out to Hashem because of the Chichuch on Shabbat. And the chikuch over here, as Rashi explains, is that there's shchin. It's a plague or some sort of disease or contagious disease that causes boils and blisters on individuals. You're allowed to call out on Shabbat to stop this plague or to stop this problem. And a door that is closed will not quickly be opened. And one who purchases a house in Eretz Yisrael, you're allowed to write the contract even on Shabbat. Now the Gemara is going to go through each one of these. Meitavei, b'shar purniyot tamid rakashot uvaot al tzibur. When it comes to any other dangers or difficulties that come on the congregation, kagon, and these are the examples, chichuch, which would be shchin, chagav, and locust, zvuv, flies, tzira, waps, mbiz, v'itush, or mosquitoes, v'shiluach, nechashim, rakravim, or a large infestation of snakes or scorpions, all of which are dangerous. They did not used to do a hatra'ah, they only did tzoakim. One of the items mentioned here is chikuch. So there you're allowed to be tzoak, but not be matria. Lokasha, that's not a problem. Kan belach, kan beyavesh. Depends if it's moist or if it is dried out. As Rashi says over here, the yavesh, the dry one, is much more incessant and problematic, and that we allow you to be matriya on Shabbat, whereas the lach one is something that is easier to both deal with, as well as the possibility of curing it, and therefore you would only be tzoweik. Damar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Shechin Shevi HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mitzrim, lach mi bachutz veyavesh mi bifnim. The Shechin that Hashem brought on the Mitzrim was moist on the inside and dry on the outside. Shenemar, vayehi Shechin ha-babu'ot poreach v'adama b'neimah. Ha-babu'ot means that it bubbled up. So the bubbling up is on the outside that it was lach, but implying that inside of it was dry. And from this, Rashi concludes that the dry Shechin is more pernicious and pervasive, and therefore it is more difficult. There are Rishonim like the Rambam who believe just the opposite, that the moist one was more problematic than the Yavesh, and that's what the emphasis in Rabbi Shimon Levi's statement is, that the moist one was on the outside, because that is a more difficult type of Shechin. Rashi explains the difference between being Matriya and Soeik as being that Matriya means to blow the shofar, Soeik means to daven. And so we allow you to daven, meaning to ask and beseech Hashem on Shabbat for these items, even though generally you don't ask or make requests on Shabbat. But because it's a horat sha'ah, or for the moment is necessary and there's a sakana on Shabbat itself, therefore we allow you to daven. But Soakim, as Rashi says, is only biyachid. We allow you individually. The congregation as a whole doesn't get together. On the other hand, matri'in, as Rashi says over, b'tzibur b'tchina, publicly in the congregation, tchina u'bishofarot v'chatzotzrot, with a shofar and a chatzotzrot, and that's as explained in Masechet Tanit. So Rashi describes the difference between a shofar and a communal type of tefillah and beseeching of Hashem versus private crying out in tefillah to Hashem. And that's how Rashi sees the difference between these two items. Tosafot is very bothered by Rashi's explanation, both here and Gemara and Tanit. He also mentions it, which is the fact that how can you have hatrab and shofar on Shabbat? We know that shofar on Shabbat is a sur, even for Rosh Hashanah, where it's a mitzvah d'oraita, that we don't allow shofar on Shabbat. How are we going to allow you to say, have a hatra'ah, and blow the shofar for something that maybe is a danger, but it's not any mitzvah d'oraita? So Tosafot says that hatra'ah is ela b'peh, b'aneinu. That means that it's tefillah also, but it's a tefillah t'aneinu that we say it. The problem that Tosafot runs into then is, what's the difference between hatra'ah and tzaka'ah? If Hatra'ah is davening and saying Aneinu, then what is Tzaka'ah? So one possibility is to use the second part of Rashi's Perush and to say that one of them is done publicly. Aneinu is a communal type of tefillah versus Tzaka'ah, which is a personal type of tefillah. But Tosafot over here tries to wordsmith it into the Gemara and say that this is the way to explain it. The Kamar b'Shabbat Matriin l'chol ha'pachot b'Aneinu. Since you're allowed to be matri on Shabbat for aneinu and say aneinu, in kain ra'ui lasot ala chichuch hatra'ah afilu b'shofar b'chol, then you should be able to blow the shofar on chol for that reason, meaning that's a big enough issue that if we allow you to daven on Shabbat and violate the normal restrictions of beseeching Hashem on Shabbat, then certainly on a weekday you should blow the shofar, because this is a serious issue. And then we ask from the Gemara in Tanit, which says no, that you only are tzoweik and you don't blow the shofar. And that would be on a weekday. So Tosafot associates it with the weekday and not with the Shabbat itself. So the next statement is, Gedelet aninelet lo b'meira tipatach. A door that is closed that will not quickly be opened. Mahi, what is this referencing to? Marzutra mar smicha, and we're talking about giving of smicha. There is a story in the beginning of the Gemara in Sanhedrin with regards to the attempts to get Rav smicha. And then lo mistaya milta, it didn't work out, it was difficult. So we have problems sometimes in just getting the people together to give the smicha, and especially in a time when the Roman persecutions were going on, and it was hard to give smicha, then if the opportunity passes to give smicha, then sometimes the door just closes, which means that you have to seize the moment, because you never know if it's going to be opened again. And that's what it means here, that when the door is open, you got to do it, because once the door closes, it's not easily reopened again. We may not find the opportunity to do it again. That's with regards to smicha, according to Marzutra. Vashi Amar, when things are going bad for someone, then they don't quickly get good for them. Or when something gets difficult for an individual, it doesn't easily get freed up. Forget about that not quickly. They never get better for him. That's not true. It does with difficulty. The tide does turn and the mazel does turn. But he was speaking about his own situation in which they had gathered together to make him into the Rosh Yeshiva, as the Gemara in Bava Batra tells us. But at that same time, they went ahead and there was another group of Chachamim that jumped the gun and made someone else the Rosh Yeshiva in front of him. And Rav Acham Yedipty's then appointment was postponed. And he always looked forward to the time when he would be the Rosh Yeshiva, meaning in the future, and it never came about. And that's what he says. There was that moment of opportunity where he would have been the Rosh Yeshiva. And since he was passed over at that time, it never would come again, that opportunity. That was his personal experience. But the Gemara says that's not true, that it doesn't ever come back, but it is difficult to bring those opportunities back. Many times, it's once in a lifetime, or these cycles have very long duration to them, and therefore, when the opportunity arises, you have to seize it, otherwise, those doors may not be opened again. The Marsha over here has a very interesting explanation, which says that when a person loses out on a position of kavod, if they think that is something bad for them, then in reality, things won't be good for them for a while. Because we know that there is a view within Chazal that Gematzinu bekama makamot shiyu tamid chachamim borchim in asrara, that they used to run away from kavod and leadership. Velo haya ra beinehem shenidchu, and they didn't look at it as negative that they were passed over for those positions of leadership. And therefore, someone who thinks that that's a problem, lo bimheira meitivin lo, won't be good for him for a while, because he's mitzta'er al kach, he's upset about the fact that he lost out on this bad thing, which is called srara. And therefore, if the Marsha almost turns on its head and says, yes, that you were passed over, if you look at that as being something bad, you're right, things won't be good for you for a long time. But if you realize not having this srara is actually beneficial to you, and that it's a better situation for you, then mitivin lo, it'll be good for you. And the last one is, v'alokeach bayit b'eretz Yisrael kodvim alav ono, afilu b'shabbat. The Marsha says, b'shabbat salgadatcha? Writing on Shabbat is an Isser Doraita. Why would you be allowed to purchase property in Eretz Yisrael and write a contract, which is an Isser Doraita, in order to purchase it? Elagdama Rava Hatam, modified or qualified by the statement of Rava Hatam. Kadama Rava Hatam, like Rava says over there, Omer Lenachri Ve'oseh, he tells the Nachri to do it. Achanami, Omer Lenachri Ve'oseh. He tells the non-Jew to do it on his behalf, which is basically Amira La'akum, which is restricted by the Chachamim, asking a non-Jew to do Malacha for you. Even though that's an Isser Drabanan, which is known as a Shvut, the Rabbanan waived that Din Drabanan for the purposes of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is so important, and the purchasing of the property from the non-Jew to the Jew, which also involves an additional removal of the restriction of Lotiten Lem Chaneya Ba'aretz, therefore the Chachamim waived the issue of Amir La'akum in order to close the transaction and make sure that the sale wasn't reversed and that Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is accomplished. Now, Balei HaTosafot over here spent a lot of time trying to understand what the implications of this are. Does this have broader implications, meaning that anytime we have a mitzvah like Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, therefore we allow you to violate Dinei Derabanan in order to accomplish the mitzvah? The Tosafot says that doesn't seem right. He says, Dafka Mishum Mitzvah Zo Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. This is a unique din to Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Aval letzorach mitzvah acheret lo shari amir le'akum. Amir le'akum is not permitted for any other mitzvah. Afilu letzorach milah, even for doing a brit milah, which is a din d'oraita. Mashma, he says, based on the Gemara in Erevin and the Gemara in Perek Rav Elazar the milah on Shabbat, the lo shari amir le'akum bisura d'oraita, that when it comes to an isur d'oraita, amir le'akum is not allowed. And therefore, Tosafot says this sees this dispensation as being extremely narrow, associated solely with Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, not even for this great mitzvah of milah do we allow you to do Amir La'akam when it comes to a violation of a din d'oraita. And then the Tosafot goes on to say that the Rish says, Afilu Yisur D'Rabbanan, Omer Rish, Ein Latir Mishum Mitzvah Acheret Al Yedei Nachri. Even in Yisur D'Rabbanan, we don't allow Amir La'akam to be violated in order to accomplish a mitzvah, even when the violation is only in Yisur D'Rabbanan, which is otherwise known as a Shvut D'Shvut, which means it's a double derabanan. Amir la'akum is a din derabanan. You have an isur derabanan. We don't allow you to violate the amir la'akum to allow that nachri to violate the isur derabanan in order to accomplish a mitzvah. The davka b'mila, tehi gufa dochi shabbat, because that's only true by a mila, where it itself is docha the shabbat, shari yaday nachri isur derabanan. We allow you to violate the isurim derabanan. So Tosafot over here creates a hierarchy of mitzvot. There are mitzvot like Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, which is so important that we allow you to violate the Amir Le'akum even with the Yisurim D'Oraita. There are other mitzvot too. The mitzvah integrally is Docha Shabbat, like the mitzvah of Milah. Over there, we do not allow Amir Le'akum to violate Dinim D'Oraita, but But we will allow Amira De'akum to violate Isurim De'Rabbanan. But by any other mitzvah, even when it's only an Isur De'Rabbanan, we won't allow Amira De'akum in order to violate it. So for instance, if you don't have a shofar to do the mitzvah d'oraita of shofar, which we don't allow you to violate Shabbat, to blow the shofar for Rosh Hashanah, over there we wouldn't allow you to do Amir L'Akum for the Akum to violate a Din D'Rabbanan, like coming Chutz L'Tchum, or some other item, or Isur D'Rabbanan, we wouldn't allow you to ask the Nachri to do it in order to bring the shofar so you can blow the shofar on Shabbat. That's Tosafot's conclusion, but then he quotes the Bahag, which seemingly disagrees, and the Bahag concludes, V'yobahag mashmad afilu Isur D'Raita sharia yidei Nachri l'tzorach milah. He says that when it comes to the Brit Milah, the Bahag seems to say that Amir L'Akum is allowed even to violate Dinim De'oraita, not just Dinim De'rabbanan. And then Tosafot goes and tries to then extend what the implications are of this Din of the Bahag, as to whether then maybe on Yom Tov Sheni we would be allowed to do things for Milah, even on Yidei Yisrael. But then in the end says maybe the cases are not comparable. But over here Tosafot is grappling with the implications of this Din, but he clearly narrows them down to at least mitzvah there to Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And with regards to Milah, he brings both the Rishita, which is that there it's only for Dinei D'Rabbanan that Amir L'Akum is allowed, whereas the Bahag says it's for Dinei D'Oraita. But similarly, everyone agrees that with other mitzvot, Amir L'Akum is not allowed, even when it comes to Dinei D'Rabbanan. So Amar Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani, Amar Rabbi Yonatan, Halokei Achir b'Eretz Yisrael, someone who purchases a city in Eretz Yisrael, compel him to open up roadways or access points from all four sides, Mishum Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, for the settlement or the purpose of settlement of Eretz Yisrael. Or in other words, if someone buys a city, we're going to compel him to put in the proper infrastructure so that the buying of the city will result in people living there and Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. If he doesn't put in the proper infrastructure, then people aren't going to live there, and then his buying of the city is going to end up being problematic and actually detracting from Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. So if he buys the city, we then compel him to give access routes from all sides to make it compelling to live in this place and to enhance or encourage Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the bottom of Pei Amud Bet.